welcome to the 300 to 350 show, the weekly independent climate change bulletin that's made for Resonance FM in London and syndicated to community radio and independent media around the globe. The sun is shining here after several days of non-stop rain, and we're pleased to be able to open the show with three more reasons to be cheerful. Yesterday it was revealed that the E.ON Energy Group has shelved its plans to build a new coal-fired power station at King's North in Kent, blaming the global recession, which they say is pushing back demand. The International Energy Association, famous for its ever-upward forecasts of global energy consumption, as if peak oil and climate change never existed, is predicting that greenhouse gas emissions will fall 3% globally in 2009 due to the recession. And in the US, it's reported that domestic emissions have fallen by 9% over the last couple of years, with analysts pointing to a mix of increasing wind power in the energy mix, as well as falling demand due to the recession and preceding spike in oil prices. In the face of what oftentimes feels like overwhelming odds, have we finally turned the corner? Meanwhile, as we go to air, the UN climate talks are concluding their penultimate day of a two-week session in Bangkok. It seems like things are reaching a bit of a crisis point there, and we'll give you a full analysis of the final outcome next week when the dust has settled. But our focus this week is on the forestry element of the UN climate talks, something we touched on back in December 2008, around the time of the talks in Poznan. We'll be hearing from Tony Juniper shortly about a new emergency forest plan put together by the Prince of Wales Forestry Project. But first, as the result of a press briefing by the Ecosystems Climate Alliance in Bangkok on Monday, we have to wag our fingers at the European Union, who seem to be putting the integrity of the UN agreement on deforestation at risk. Here's Peg Putt, Senior Forest Policy Expert of the Wilderness Society.
The reason we've called this media conference for today is because the negotiations on RED, the mechanism being negotiated to reduce emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, are at a turning point. It's probably not overstating it to say that when the negotiating text came on the table on Saturday, the analysis shows that RED is in crisis. It is busy being made over from something that was meant to be designed to protect intact natural forests in order to save fully a quarter of emissions that are coming out of carbon reservoirs on the planet, being made over instead into a logging mechanism. The key culprit here is the EU. Their fingerprints are all over the introduction of logging language and the change in intent of the mechanism. The way the text is written at the moment, it gives carte blanche for introduction of industrial-scale logging to intact natural forests, clear felling, conversion of such forests. And there is no wording that says that forests would be protected under a RED mechanism. It's a very serious situation, and as I pointed out at the outset, the EU has its fingerprints all over it. When we've examined the various iterations of the text and the attributions of who's put this language in, it is clearly the EU that has been insistent on this SFM, Sustainable Forest Management, language, rather than the Bali Action Plan language of sustainable management of forests. A seemingly minor but extraordinarily significant change, particularly taken together with the failure to be clear about wanting to stop wholesale conversion of natural forest to plantation, and together with the absence of wording that would provide for the protection of intact natural forests.
Emissions from deforestation account for around 17% of annual global emissions currently, and forests absorb something like 15% of our annual emissions. So it's clear that stopping deforestation is critical if we wish to stop catastrophic climate change. an agreement on reduced emissions from deforestation and forest degradation, or RED as it's known in conference speak, is on the table at the UN talks and should form part of the global deal which negotiators hope to finalise in Copenhagen in December. At its core, the proposal is that someone gets paid for not cutting down forests. However, there are still major questions to be resolved. Who gets paid? Who ends up owning the forests? How are the rights of forest-dependent indigenous peoples protected? How will the finance be raised? Will funds come from rich country governments directly, or from carbon credits, which rich countries can buy up as offsets from a carbon trading market as a way of meeting their national emissions targets? And as we heard a moment ago, will the scheme end up supporting the replacement of old-growth forests with plantations, which have a much smaller value as a carbon sink? While these questions are being debated at the UN climate talks, the Prince of Wales Rainforest Project has gone ahead and put together what they are calling an emergency package for tropical forests, which they say could and should be put in place in advance of any UN deal. They've launched a Rainforest SOS campaign, fronted by the likes of Sting, David Attenborough, Joanna Lumley and Robin Williams. Here's HRH himself in a video message.
As I'm sure you know, rainforests are utterly essential in our fight against climate change. They absorb nearly a fifth of our carbon dioxide emissions, and yet they are being destroyed at the rate of a football pitch every 4 seconds. To solve the problem, we have to find ways to ensure that the trees become more valuable alive than dead, so that there is no incentive to cut them down. The world's leaders are gathering in Copenhagen later this year for crucially important climate discussion. So it is essential that when they meet, they do so knowing that there is an enormous public will and desire for them to take the necessary action to protect the rainforests of the world and put them at the heart of the climate change debate. So, ladies and gentlemen, my message to you, therefore, is quite simple. Saving the rainforests can help save us all before it really is too late. Please will you take the time to sign up to the campaign? You really could make the whole difference.
To find out more about the scheme, I spoke to Tony Juniper, former director of Friends of the Earth in England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Here he is speaking to me by mobile phone from Brussels earlier in the week.
You're special advisor to the Prince's Rainforest Project.
Yeah.
And you've written in The Guardian recently that you think that the UN climate talk should be preempted in a sense by setting up an emergency package to save the rainforests, which is the proposal that the Prince's Rainforest Project are putting forward. Can you explain the rationale for that and outline the key features of that proposal?
Well, everybody hopes that the climate change negotiations that take place in Copenhagen at the end of 2009 will deliver an agreement that will help to cut deforestation. But even with the best will in the world, we've come to the conclusion that it will take some years for an agreement that's thrashed out there to be turned into practical action on the ground in terms of actually cutting forest loss, which is why we've come to the conclusion that an emergency response is needed and that we would hope to see that being talked about in a practical way before the Copenhagen summit in December. Not only would that be a way of helping to put resources towards cutting deforestation in the short term, it would also help to increase the chances of there being a bigger deal at Copenhagen, because forests obviously is not the only thing on the agenda there. And there's questions of adaptation and how countries will be able to cope with the effects of climate change and the measures needed to do that. There will also be discussions about the reduction targets that countries will have for their industrial emissions. And if we could come there with a practical set of proposals in how we can put resources behind cutting forest loss very quickly, we think that would be good not only from the forest but also from the wider perspective of the Copenhagen talks.
Okay, I mean, that would, as I say, preempt in a sense the kind of democratic United Nations process. Do you think there are some important features in the proposal which the UNFCCC process would benefit from taking on?
Well, it's true that an emergency response, if it's put out beforehand, would in some ways be ahead of the Copenhagen deal. But it's important to remember that not every country in the world has tropical rainforests, and not every country in the world would want to participate in a program to save them, even if they don't have rainforests. So the kind of discussions that have been going on in the last few months have involved about 35 countries, including those that have big chunks of forest and those that are in a position to help fund the rescue of those forests. And we believe, you know, that is a sufficiently participative process for there now to be significant action. You know, and the former Soviet republics, for example, like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, they will be at the negotiating table in the UN, but they neither have rainforests nor the resources to help save them. And so, you know, having them as part of the wider discussion is essential. But we do believe that it is possible for a group of countries to go ahead of the Copenhagen conversation in saying that actually, you know, we've come up with a set of proposals that we think are practical and which we think can be actioned immediately. And that would, you know, not only, as I say, help to save the forest, but also to create the space that people would feel more trusting and more positive about the wider prospects for Copenhagen.
In terms of paying for forest conservation, which is essentially what's happening in your proposal and in a lot of the discussion around RED at the UN, I've never understood, so perhaps you can explain, how do you stop deforestation just moving around if you don't also tackle demand at the same time?
Yeah, the so-called question of leakage is a crucial one. This is the phenomenon whereby stopping deforestation in one area simply displaces the economic pressures somewhere else in terms of the demand for logs or for soybeans or for cattle. And that's why we've said that the proposals that come with an emergency response to slow down deforestation need to be global in nature. It's no good having one country taking action simply for the deforestation to go down the road. And so there does need to be a simultaneous agreement between a number of countries in order to capture that leakage so that the economic incentives to keep the forest intact are applied to all countries that are potentially going to be part of those markets for palm oil or soybeans where forest is under threat. That is a tall order, but, you know, that's probably the only way this is going to work in terms of being able to make an emergency response, because tackling demand at the global level, which is what you'd have to do as well, looks like it will be pretty impossible given the growth rates taking place right now in India and China and elsewhere, where demand for tropical commodities is not only adding to what's already there in the West, but rapidly accelerating as lifestyles are changing for people to want more meat, for example, and more consumer goods. So we do need a demand-side response, but it's not going to happen very quickly, we've concluded. And therefore, you know, the application of a response to the tropical countries on the ground simultaneously, if at all possible, looks like it might work better.
I mean, there are things that could be done fairly straight away, aren't there? I mean, the biofuels targets that the EU are mandating and I think reviewing next year, 10% rising to 20% mandatory.
I think 5 to 10%, I think.
Right, okay. I mean, that is already causing terrible problems in terms of land grabs, deforestation and dispossession for people all over the world. I mean, that should be addressed straight away, shouldn't it? I think the Food and Agricultural Organization, Committee on Forestry, actually, in a report recently, identified that as one of the major drivers of deforestation currently.
Looking forward to the next 10 years and beyond, the increasing demands on land globally are going to be very significant. This is in terms of land to grow food for people, and not only do we have an increasing population, but a more affluent population wishing to eat more meat and dairy products. That's going to increase the demand for agricultural space. On top of that, we have demand for fibre and various crops used to produce materials that we need, for example, paper, so wood crops. On top of that, then you have demand for bioenergy, some of which is grossly unsustainable and some of which is more sustainable. But laid across the whole lot of that, of course, we have rapid climate change. And so, you know, we have a really demanding equation to balance. And at the same time, in the case of the biofuels, you know, also the potential for there to be an oil peak reached in the next few years. So this is an extremely difficult and tense situation that's going to require action at all levels. And yes, biofuels is a part of the equation, but focusing on that on its own, which you know, sometimes is tempting because there is a clear policy that lies behind it, and certainly in Europe, I don't think we necessarily solve the problem. So, you know, we need a holistic approach to land use, a holistic approach towards consumption patterns, and a more holistic approach towards how, you know, we measure even some of the fundamentals of how societies work in terms of how economic growth and economies are measured. All of these things have to go alongside the specific evaluation of particular policies, including biofuels. One of the things we've said, which is potentially a big opportunity, is for resources that are being transferred to cut deforestation, not only compensating national governments for the opportunity costs of leaving their forests intact, but at the same time being used to restore degraded agricultural lands that could be in production but which presently aren't. And if they were restored properly and would have their fertility put back, could be increasing food production at the same time as stabilising the frontier of deforestation approach that could be taken. But, you know, the demand side, yes, you know, we do need to be eating less meat as a global community. We do need to be looking at how we're going to be fueling the global economy going forward. And we do need to be thinking, you know, about the waste that's in the global food chain, especially in the West. But I fear that, you know, even if we did get a grip on some of those things, and it will take some time to do that, then, you know, we're still not going to be solving the problem purely from a demand point of view because, you know, of the momentum that's coming from people coming out of poverty in some of the big developing countries.
In terms of where's the money going to go, I've never understood that either. Yeah. Who ends up owning the forests?
Yeah, so the transfer of money that we have talked about in our proposals is basically between an institution that would collect funds from effectively the donor community and then would transfer it to countries who would be agreeing through a negotiation to be cutting deforestation by a specified amount. Now, in terms of how countries then distribute that cash in terms of their economic development, you know, would be subject to a process that they would run themselves. And so, you know, we wouldn't envisage there being an international agency that's specifying how money is distributed inside countries, but would require that countries would conduct a process to ensure that the distribution of benefits are fair, that the process to decide it is inclusive and that governance is good and that there's accountability for actions taken. And, you know, to that extent, we would hope that the benefits would be spread widely and would get down to the grassroots level. And so one country that has already embarked on this process because they've seen the logic of payments for performance as being part of their economic development going forward is Guyana. They've been in a negotiation with the whole of their society about how this could work, including with the indigenous people and other forest people, and have reached an accommodation as to how benefits would be shared in terms of payments received from the international community to keep the forest where it is rather than turning it into soya beans or logging camps. So, you know, there can be a way of doing this, but, you know, I don't think anyone should be under the illusion that the problems that have dogged development in terms of failures of governance and corruption that have been there for 60 years are going to be solved by a new mechanism that's trying to do an emergency response to stop tropical deforestation. I think that would be an unrealistic expectation. At the same time, however, if we don't do something along the lines that we've described, we believe, you know, that the economic failures that have continued to promote deforestation over the last 30 years, despite the best efforts of NGOs and international companies and governments, everybody else, it will continue. And so, you know, we're going to have to accept that there will be some ragged edges and the response will not be perfect because nothing in the world is perfect working at that scale and with that level of ambition. However, you know, sitting by and looking at all the problems and therefore not implementing the solutions will guarantee one thing, and that is a continuing contribution of about 20% per year of carbon dioxide emissions coming from land use change in tropical countries.
I don't know if you've been following the UN negotiations on this, but
a little.
But the Ecosystems Climate Alliance held a kind of emergency press briefing during the week, and they were scathing about the EU. They were saying they've traced the introduction of language into the text by the EU, which basically would subsidise logging and clear felling and conversion to plantations. They're talking about the sustainable forest management language, which they say is poorly defined. I mean, plantations replacing old growth rainforest is a terrible thing in terms of the climate, biodiversity and various ecosystem services. What's your view on plantations?
Well, the way we've looked at this is to see the kind of proposals that we're making for an emergency response as being a bridge to something that could follow later on, which would be more at the multilateral United Nations level. I mean, the proposals we're making have multilateral consensus forming behind them, but, you know, it's a bridge to something bigger later on. You know, in terms of what that bridge goes to, clearly the emphasis, as far as this discussion is concerned, has to be on the protection of the old growth, native, natural climax forests that remain. And replacing those with plantations makes no sense in terms of biodiversity or climate protection or the protection of wider ecosystem services. It might make economic sense to some actors under some circumstances, and everyone would hope that the negotiators at the United Nations would spot that they have to guard against any inadvertent signals being sent to people that would put short-term economic interests over the protection of the high-carbon remaining natural forest. And so, you know, that's something to be watched between here and Copenhagen. But of course, you know, lots of different interests are involved in this discussion, some of them with, you know, very good intentions, others with vested interests lying behind the positions they take. And it would be hoped that countries would keep an eye on the main objective of this process, which is to arrive at an ecologically workable treaty, but one which also goes with the flow of development. What we don't want is vested interests to be hijacking particular elements of this in order to, you know, sustain business objectives which don't necessarily reflect long-term interests of the climate. And I'm sure that, you know, countries are perfectly capable of doing that.
In terms of the UN talks, it's not clear at the moment. I think there's at least a split on whether the funds should be kind of market-based or fund-based.
Yes.
And there's terrific dangers of a market, as I see it, because it could just be used as an offsetting mechanism for the rich world to undermine their zero-carbon transitions. But I understand that your proposal doesn't include a market. It's more of a mechanisms for raising funds from national budgets and forestry bonds.
The approach we've taken is to point out how the economic failures of deforestation can be corrected through performance-based payments that effectively would compensate countries for keeping their forests intact and for not embarking on a different development path that would involve deforestation. And, you know, we've not talked at this stage about market mechanisms in terms of the generation of tradable credits from this. But what we have talked about is how the donor community, in the widest sense, could mobilise resources to pay countries for that performance-based effort. In terms of how rich countries could be recouping their money over time in terms of protecting their national balance of payments, you know, we've talked about forest bonds, which would effectively be a way of governments going to the capital markets, raising money in the short term, spending that money now on stopping deforestation, and then raising that money once more over the 10 or 15 years through the maturity of the bond to then repay back to the investors. And they could use a whole range of measures to do that. So they could be deploying Tobin taxes, for example, they could be taxing aviation fuel, or they could be using the proceeds of domestic emissions trading schemes, which are a market-based instrument, but using that to repay the bondholders. So we've not said that there needs to be a market now. Negotiators at the United Nations may decide that some market mechanism is acceptable in the future. I would have personally grave concerns about that being used as an offsetting opportunity for industrialized countries who need to be decarbonizing. But for the moment, the emergency response that we've conceived doesn't talk about market mechanisms in the sense of generating forest-based carbon credits.
That was Tony Juniper, Senior Advisor to the Prince's Rainforest Project, former Director of Friends of the Earth, author of How Many Light Bulbs Does It Take to Change a Planet, and Green Party general election candidate for Cambridge. Meanwhile, back in the negotiations on Monday, members of the 100-strong Indigenous Peoples Delegation in Bangkok held a protest outside the conference centre to highlight the fact that the language in the UN text on deforestation was insufficiently strong to ensure their land rights. At the beginning of the current set of talks, the Indigenous Environmental Network released a report which they titled Red, Reaping Profits from Evictions, Land Grabs and Deforestation and the Destruction of Biodiversity. We had arranged to speak to Tom Goldtooth of IEN this morning, but the mobile phone connection to Bangkok wasn't sufficiently up to it. But Indigenous peoples agreed a common position at the International Indigenous Peoples Forum on Climate Change in Anchorage earlier in the year. Their final declaration said that all initiatives under RED must secure the recognition and implementation of the rights of Indigenous peoples, including the security of land tenure, ownership, recognition of land title according to traditional ways, uses and customary laws, and the multiple benefits of forests for climate, ecosystems, and peoples before taking any action. They also challenged delegates at the UN talks to abandon false solutions, amongst which they include agrofuels, plantations and forest offsets. On Monday, the Ecosystems Climate Alliance started a Forest Pledge initiative, calling for the protection of intact natural forests and the rights of indigenous peoples and forest communities. Here's Peg Putt again.
The bright light is the countries who've signed a forest pledge that we have got up here this week. But they're not the countries that would be giving them money. They're the countries that need to look after their forests. So far we have 9 countries: Nigeria, Uganda, Malawi, Mexico, Indonesia, Paraguay, Fiji, the Solomon Islands, PNG, and Serbia, all saying very clearly on this forest pledge that they support protecting intact natural forest and restoring degraded natural forests as a core objective of a RED mechanism, and that this includes protecting the rights and interests of Indigenous peoples and forest communities in such forests. We need to get this back into the text, or in fact in at all. It hasn't been there. It's sorely lacking. The opportunity is tomorrow morning in the RED session, where countries have to come forward. Parties will be saying what it is that's missing. If there's no articulation that protecting forests has gone missing and that the loggers are taking over the agenda, then we are in dire circumstances, as indicated by the EU position.
We'll return to forests next week, as well as getting the lowdown on what moved and what didn't at the UN talks in Bangkok. In the meantime, do visit the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org. This has been the 300 to 350 show. Thanks for listening.